I'm so excited to tell you JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. What I love about Walker Hayes is his laid-back nature. He's a family man and being a country megastar while also having 7 kids. You know he likes to keep his style cool and casual. This new collection is perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear, affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Zone Media.
So listen, this year is going to be a ton of wild news that is bleak, newsflash. Like this year is any different. But what I wanted to do this year was not just present to y'all the bleakness. I want to bring to y'all some of the most dopest people I've met over the years that are actually making the world better. Because it's really hard to see that sometimes in the midst of all the noise. And even among the people that you know, actually, like, really outside trying to do good, there's always some sort of asterisk next to their name. I know this firsthand, which we can get into a little later. This series is called Terraform. Now, some of y'all may know I have a coffee company. It's called Terraform Cold Brew. But that origin story comes from a poetry book that I wrote called Terraform, Building a Livable World. And out of that book has 4 musical EPs. The last albums I've dropped have been all based around the book Terraform and what Terraform means. Terraform is the process of making a planet livable. And as I looked around in the world, I'm like, yo, you know, this planet is getting less and less livable. So what if we saw our own planet, our politics, our culture, our nations, our environment, our communities, our families, and ultimately ourselves as terraforming projects? So the poetry in those books are around those sort of ideas. And then out of that came the Cold Brew Company. But ultimately, it's a call to action. It's a mission. Build a livable world and imagine a better future. Which is why me and Cool Zone Media got along so well. Because ultimately, this is our hope. We're not just reporting on how the world sucks. We're reporting on ways and people that are actually making it better. Terraformers. So I'm going to bring you different people that are really outside building a livable world. As always, you can go to my personal website, prophiphop.com. You can get the book. You can stream the records. But right now, I want to introduce you to my man, Shamil. Shamil is the CEO of an org called Search for Common Ground. Backstory with that, I was, for many years, I went from a fan to an ambassador to an artist in residence to a board member of an organization called Preemptive Love. Preemptive Love had a very similar vision to Search for Common Ground. Matter of fact, it is almost like it was, if Preemptive Love did everything right in 30 years, we would look like Search. Preemptive Love was, again, a peacemaking organization, right, who existed in conflict regions wherever there's violence. And if you're a peace-building org, that's a little different than peace first response, although that's a part of what you have to do. Sometimes you just got to stop the bleeding before you can broker peace. So we were in, and still are in, Iraq, Venezuela, the Juarez at the Mexican border, Israel, Palestine, and then was moving into Afghanistan. How you build peace varies based on what the needs are of the community. I've mentioned this org in a lot of my music. I just believed in what they were trying to do, the way that they were doing it. There was some drama that happened in Preemptive Love that made it to where the org had to merge. And it wasn't that they were not working with refugees. They worked a lot with refugees, Syrian refugees specifically. Problem was internal. There was a lot that happened that eventually we had to take the org and merge it under org that had a much more established infrastructure internally. And that's how we got to Search for Common Ground. Because what they were doing while we were in five countries, they was in 30 countries. While we were still ran by our founder, they had gone through two CEO transitions, was just doing a lot right. And that's how we partnered up. What they were able to do very well. I'm doing all this just so that we can get to the meat when we actually talk to Idris or Shamil Idris. That's his last name. What we were doing well was we were telling our story well. Like, people saw and knew exactly what was going on the ground because we was telling y'all, like, this is what we was doing. So as you know how NGOs work, like, you got to raise money. And that money being raised for us was like, well, it's real simple. If people just see what we're doing, do that. So we had a donor base of just like small donors of citizens, community, people that cared about it. We had a pretty big donor list. What we were not good at was getting the big government grants. So there were certain things that we couldn't do. What we loved about Search for Common Ground, which I'm now on the board of over there, was that they were incredible at getting the big government grants because receipts they were able to put together for the things that they've done. I mean, by God, they're in Darfur right now. My Lord, the part of the Myanmar civil war down there, like, guess who was at the table brokering that peace? We're going to talk about it later. It's crazy. They would get the government grants and they wouldn't put their logos on stuff because they were like, well, it's really not about us. It's about the peace. It's about the peace building. They'd be 10-year programs that they put together. And they felt like, well, it's lame to like put our logo on stuff and like shove cameras in our workers' faces because that sucks. Like, let them just do the work. Like, it's not about that. They felt like it was sensationalized and it would cheapen the work if we was putting it all on social media. To whereas at Preemptive Love, we was like, no, we're trying to celebrate y'all. Like, y'all doing the real work. You feel me? Like, if people want to be a part of what y'all doing. So there was a mind shift. So we had what they needed and they had what we needed. Anyway, that's, y'all hear from me all the time. Y'all need to hear from Shamil. So peep this up. Ladies and gentlemen, please say what's up to the homie, a hero, an incredible person who don't like his name on stuff, which is part of what I like about him, is my man Shamil. Am I saying that right, Shamil or Shamil?
Yeah, Shamil.
Shamil, okay. Shamil.
I've heard worse.
You've heard worse?
Yeah, I've heard a lot worse. That's fine. Thanks, bro.
I tried to Swahili it. Man, so... First of all, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Happy holidays. Hope you got a good break.
I did, man. We had a chance to finally kick it in person this past, right before the holiday shutdown in New York City with the rest of the board. I had a dope little meeting. I got to meet these people in person. Super crazy experience. And like, I'm like everybody else where I feel like, why am I here? Like, what?
Yeah, because after we broke up, everyone on our senior leadership team was like, I love that guy. Because you would come in and, you know, we'd be having these conversations about all this stuff, complex stuff, whatever. You just kind of cut right to the, you had this like artist's eye.
Yes.
The nub of something.
Yes.
I'm like, you would say in like three clear words, but we said like four paragraphs. So I thought that was great.
Oh man, that's fun, man. That's actually kind of what we do here on this show is like, you know, people say a whole lot of, you know, blah, 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 whoopty whoop, a whole lot of big terms to try to say something that I'm like, hey, are you just saying You don't want to pay for it? Is that what you're saying? Like, that's all you're trying to say, right? Is you don't want to pay for it. Okay, then say that, you know. But yeah, anyway, Search for Common Ground. One of the most unique NGOs out there because of, one, their philosophical approach, and two, the fact that, like, if it's a very much if you know, you know type situation, you know, and that's for our community. Like, we like stuff like that. Like, people like the prophet Lil Wayne, he has a lyric where he said, real G's move in silence like lasagna, because the G is silent. That's anyway.
Right.
So, yeah. So like, so, you know, you real if you moving in silence, like nobody's, there's no, you know, your logo's not on all this stuff. You're not out here flashy. I'm out here doing the work, you know, and that's what we really loved about Search for Common Ground. And there's receipts, the proof's in the pudding. Like, this is what we do. Here's examples. 40 years of receipts, of experience, of proof that, like, we're really out here building peace. So I'm done talking. I'm going to ask you a couple questions to introduce y'all to the, or so that people can see, like, really what they're doing out here. So first of all, this org is not necessarily a humanitarian or first response thing, although that's part of what we do. But your org is a peace building organization.
That's right.
So can you break down to them, like, what you really mean by that, as in terms of it being a distinction from, like, humanitarian?
Sure. Well, thanks, Tosha, for having me. I'm here and making the G not as silent anymore by getting a platform, which is, yes, appreciated. Yeah, you know, there's so much going on in the world that people get kind of overwhelmed with all the causes and all the needs and whatever. And I guess the reason probably that Search for Common Ground is so committed to peace is it's kind of like the foundation for everything else. Think about it like oxygen. Like, nobody pays attention to it or recognizes it until it's gone. And then it's the only thing that matters, you know, because the biggest priority. And peace is really trying to create the conditions where you don't have the humanitarian crisis in the first place. And I think one of the things that we've seen over the last 20 years, people may or may not, I think people feel this in their gut, but the numbers unfortunately bear it out. The last 20 years, conflict's been going up, humanitarian crises have been rising every single year, and the gap between the needs that are out there in the world and what we're providing to meet them has also grown every year. Mm. So it's totally unsustainable, right? You got more and more humanitarian crises, bigger and bigger gap of unmet crises, and the world needs more than just more humanitarian response. We need that too. Yeah. But what we really need to do is get ahead of this and prevent more of these crises. And the things that are really driving these humanitarian crises are the climate and conflict, how we deal with conflict, how we deal with our differences. Mm-hmm.
That's brilliant. So I love it, because it's like when you think about, like, where the crisis come from, like, climate situation is causing misallocation of resources. There's not enough food to go around because there's not enough farmable ground. So then that means that people are going to grab for what they can have. And when you start grabbing and building fences around food, you're going to create violence, right?
Yeah.
That's going to happen. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So if you're talking about environmental justice, if you're talking about, you know, food, medical services, all that has to do with the fact that peace is lost. But if you come in, I know what's dope about y'all is, again, it's a 10-year approach. Like, humanitarian usually is like, let's stop the bleeding right now. What you saying is like, well, let's make sure the bleeding never starts.
That's right.
You know, and that means that there's some really hard conversations, right? And some really hard tactics that, again, for you guys, it's at least 10 years, right? When you're going to get to a place.
Yeah, when we think about it, we make generation-long commitments. So we even go double that. It's 20 years. It's a generation, which doesn't mean that you don't accomplish things in 1 year, 6 months. Mm-hmm. But in terms of really shifting systems, you know, in terms of really creating peace at scale, where it's not that you're not going to have crises, you're still going to have crises, but those crises, you're going to be able to rally to deal with them. You're not going to fall into violence, you know. And it's interesting that you talk about climate that way. You know, we've got over 1,000 full-time peace builders on the front lines in 33 countries around the world. In Africa, as an example, one of the biggest conflict dynamics across the entire continent is the farmer-herder conflict, which sounds like a small little thing. You got farmers and you have herders, okay? Yeah. People don't realize all the way from West Africa and Nigeria all the way through to Sudan in East Northeast Africa. One of the biggest conflict dynamics is because of climate, right?
Yeah.
You have people who are nomadic, the herders. They've got their livestock that they're moving across, you know, and those livestock have less and less area to graze in because it's going dry. And so they're encroaching more and more on the farmland. And so the farmers who aren't nomadic, they live in their spots, they've got their plot of land, are getting angry at the herders. And this is all exacerbated by the fact that a bunch of national boundaries were drawn across that continent.
Yeah,
that
made up.
You know, tribal communities and all that kind of stuff on top of it. So, like, that's a climate right there. You got right there. The only way to address that is to get all of those people actually together and have them figure out a solution, not impose one from the top or from outside. And the process of bringing people together like that and building enough trust that they're willing to work together on a solution that'll help everybody, that's actually a 20-year process.
Yeah, it takes a while to let some dude come in here and be like, yeah, what do you know?
Yeah.
You know, like, what do you really know about what we're going through? And one thing that is true about search is the fact that, like, well, 90% of the staff are local, born and raised. So, like, well, actually, we do know because we're from here, you know. So I think that that's a very unique situation. But, like, in what you're saying is there something that we also learned in our meeting here was the top down, bottom up approach.
Yeah.
Right? Talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, it's really popular to say all change is driven from the bottom up or all change requires good leadership. It's all true. You can't do it. You can't do it just bottom up. You can't do it just top down. Right. You know, you need to drive change from the bottom up and from the top down. And so you talked about the teams, the search for common ground teams. The search really key thing about the search for common ground teams is two things. Yes, they're local. You already mentioned that one.
Yeah.
But really importantly, they're also drawn from the communities in conflict. Like, so they're not just local, but you've got access to all the major political groups, ethnic groups. Wow. You know, if you're dealing with conflict between like police and young people in a city anywhere in the world, would help a lot if your team was made up of retired cops, youth activists, former gang leaders, who are, instead of sitting across from each other, seeing each other as the problem, are sitting side by side facing a common problem together. That sounds simple, but as everybody knows, like, that takes time.
It's very difficult.
And so when you talk, and then what they start strategizing about is, okay, look, because of unique insight, because then they say, look, if you use that word, nobody's going to listen to you in my community. Yeah. Or you know what? If you can do something in that neighborhood, you're going to have credibility for years.
Yeah.
Or you know what? If you can get that partnership, go for it. Or you know what? If you partner with that guy, nobody's going to talk to you. And you only get those insights by being both local and, we call it, multi-partial, drawn from all of the different parties, right? You're not some like outside neutral person. You are the community. And so so when you and those are the kinds of people who can talk about top-down and bottom-up change. They can talk about what needs to happen in the communities to drive the kind of change we need and what needs to happen at the level of politics and powerful institutions to make that change stick.
Yeah. That's good, man. You mentioned like a very real situation that hits home in the sense that, like, you know, you ask, like, you trying to broker peace in like a LA hood, you want me to sit across the table from a person who quite possibly murdered some of my family members, you know? And of course we don't want more murder to happen, but like, I feel like if I were to like sit down and try to talk peace with this person, I'm spitting on my family member's grave.
Yeah. Right?
And he looking at me thinking the same thing. So I'm like, if you willing to talk to me, I'm now questioning your gangster. Cause I'm like, how was you even willing to talk to me? Cause I'm not, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm like, I don't care nothing about your truce until there's too much bloodshed. Right. So there's that hurdle of sort of lived experience that again is so interesting for us too, because I'm like, at the same time, that person sitting across the table from you, man, we was in the same after school daycare. We went to the same Head Start. We was, you know, probably went to the same middle school, probably was on the same little league team. Like, they're not strangers, you know, like, I, you live two streets from me, you know? So
and our moms probably went to the same church. Like, there's this like thing about community that no matter where you put it, like you said, like nomadic tribes in Sudan, you know, or, you know, east side and west side of Los Angeles, it's like tribalism is tribalism, and a fight for resources is a fight for resources. The idea of dignity is still sitting across from there. And it, again, for me to be willing to talk to you, I need somebody, like you said, I need somebody super certified from my side that I'm like, oh, this is my OG. I'm going to listen to you. You know what I'm saying? And they need somebody from their side that, like, so when we see our OGs talking, it's like, maybe this is weird to me, but maybe something's happening here, you know?
That's really powerful the way you talk about that. Cause I don't, yeah. One thing you just triggered for me when you said that one thing we would never do, we would never push or strong arm or manipulate, or like, we would never try to get somebody to sit with somebody that they're not willing to. Like, that's not how peace is made. Like, that's kind of the worst thing you can do. Like, gee, you should really like empathize with or understand these people who are trying to annihilate you in, you know, in every other walk of life. Right. So that's not, so that's a really good point. And that dynamic exists pretty much everywhere where we work, that like real hurt and real, not just historical, but oftentimes like present and ongoing violence and injustice. And so one of the things that we do, you know, we talked about this a little bit when we were together, like one of the first things that we do in any community is, instead of asking what's going wrong, because everything's going, you know, there's so much is going wrong that it'll be, you'd get overwhelmed by it in any community that's in conflict. We ask people like, okay, if this is an ethnic divide, is there anyone in the other ethnicity who you actually trust? Or if you're dealing with a corrupt government, you know, is there one minister or even like somebody who you actually feel like is trying to serve the people? Or if it's the example that we were just talking about with police, if this is about a out of control police force, is there one captain or even just a beat cop who you feel like is, and to the police, we do the same thing. Is there anyone in the community? You say the community won't work with you. They don't want to talk to you. Is there anyone that you see playing a positive role in the community that you respect? Yeah. Right? And one of the things that we found, like 100% of the time, like 100% of the time in every community, first of all, people appreciate those questions.
Yeah.
They like not just being talked to like they're a problem. Yeah. They like being asked their own views. And then 100% of the time, you get lots of names.
Yeah.
You get lots of names. Like, no matter how bad and unjust the situation is, people are like, you know what? There's this one guy, or you know what? Yeah. There's one organizer. There's one community organizer that like everyone, you know, and those are the people that we gravitate towards. We try to understand what they're trying to make happen, how we can be helpful. Sometimes we share examples, which they can take or leave, of how people in similar situations around the world have kind of dealt with some similar dynamics. That stuff. So you build slowly that way. You don't just sort of jump in with the solution. And to your point, you got to start with we call it, you know, again, it's one of those clunky terms, appreciative inquiry, right? It's this whole approach. It's I first came across that term in like a Harvard Business Review article. It had nothing to do with war and peace. It was about how you change culture in your company.
Okay.
And I read this article and I was like, this is actually the best description of what our teams do that I'd seen, but had nothing. And so basically what appreciative inquiry says is this really well-researched field that it says the worst way to change behavior in your community, in your company, in your family, in whatever, the worst way to change behavior is to punish bad behavior. The best way to change behavior is to identify and amplify and celebrate and incentivize every step towards the desired behavior, even if it's a tiny step. Even if it's a tiny step. And I've seen this with my own daughter. Like if I yelled at my daughter, you know, for not putting her shoes in the crate that I got for that specific purpose, it works a lot worse than if I celebrate her like crazy because she put one shoe in today. She's much more likely to put two in tomorrow. Anyway, so that's the approach you take with communities in conflict too. Like, you don't go in and attack people, whatever. You try to understand, like, even if there's one small step someone takes, that's what you really amplify. You really amplify the good and you feed the good. And over time, it builds a momentum that is powerful and relentless.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
The wait is over. The Chi is back on Paramount Plus, and the stakes have never been higher. Everything changes on the South Side when a new threat comes to power in the Showtime original series from Emmy winner Lena Waithe. Battle lines will be drawn, alliances will shift, and danger lies around every corner, leaving everyone to wonder who they can trust. Visit ParamountPlus.com/The Chi to get a 50% discount off the Paramount Plus with Showtime annual plan. Offer ends July 14th. Subscription auto-renews. Restrictions apply.
Okay. I love Walker Hayes. He's amazing. He's so fun. Such a great entertainer. And that's why I'm so excited that JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. The Walker Hayes for JCPenney collection is an upbeat playlist of instant classics with laid-back appeal and down-home vibes. As a dad of 7 kids, he knows exactly what fathers want and need when it comes to their style. This collection reflects his casually cool styles with outdoor-inspired details and versatile colors. Perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th, just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
Man, yeah, there's that one cop that, like, whenever he, you know, see us on the corner, it's like, oh, he daps us up, or, you know, like, it's never, he's never out here, like, being crazy about it. It's like, if, you know, if we're selling bootleg DVDs, it's like, all right, homie, how many you got? And I'll just buy the DVDs off you, and you gotta get out of here, man. Like, you know what I mean? Like, just like stuff like that, to where it's like, okay, like, I feel you. It's like, man, I'm not finna, man, how many you need? Okay, give me this. All right, get out of here. You know what I mean? And like, those things are different. You know what I'm saying? Like, hey, what you got in that backpack? Don't even tell me. Just give it back. You know, feel me? Like, all right. You know, so there's like, there's that one dude that, like, you know, I mean, whatever. Like, I mean, I don't, whatever, but I guess he all right. Yeah. So yeah, that's good. Now let's get into some examples. Now, like you said, 33 different countries, and every country, like you said, these are like 20 year, at least 20 year processes, right? So how you actually implement these lofty ideas are, can vary as wild as your imagination can go. The two that in my head that stick out in my head are Myanmar and was it Nigeria with the soccer? Where was the soccer at?
We've done soccer tournaments in countries all around the world. Oh, okay. Congo was where we did this with Democratic Republic of Congo. It's a huge kind of 90 million people center of Africa. I'm happy to tell some of those stories.
Awesome. And the TV show, the tell some stories.
In Congo, just about, I think it was like 2010. Mm-hmm. There was a terrible thing that a very senior UN, like the most senior United Nations official in the Democratic Republic of Congo, she said she called the country the rape capital of the world, which was a horrible thing to say. But what she was trying to point out was that, like, sexual assault was like off the charts in the country. And more than half of the assaults and the rapes were committed by people in uniform. So the police or the military, abusing the very people they're supposed to be protecting. Uh-huh. So you just sort of imagine how much anger and hatred and fear community had. And our team, our Congolese team, working there, took what we call the common ground approach. It's a three-step process. First, you build trust, then you turn that trust into cooperation that actually makes a difference. And over time, that cooperation can trigger breakthroughs, right?
Yeah.
So what they did to build trust, in every community, this is different, just like you're saying, like it would be different in every community. So in Congo, teams use soccer tournaments to get the police and young people and people in the community actually doing things together. It was one of the few things they would get them to do together that wouldn't have them fighting with each other or getting into an argument. Yeah. And then they turned those into community theater performances where they would like go into communities and literally in the middle of a town square, they'd like bang on drums and call people together. Everyone would come out of their homes and sit in the town square and they put on a performance of a play. Mm-hmm. And the play was kind of dramatizing what was going on, but with a lot of humor and stuff between the police and the community. And then they turned, and that was one of the few things that would get the police and the community kind of sitting together, talking together. After those soccer tournaments, after those performances, those plays, they would open up conversations, right? And they start these community dialogues. That turned in, so that was the initial step. Just try, get people just to figure out what's going to get people to sit together, right? Yeah. And different communities, that'll be different things. But in every community, there's some stuff you can do, cultural events, something that will get people actually sitting together.
Yeah.
Then the second step was to turn that into cooperation. So those conversations they started having, they started talking about what they could do together to actually improve the situation between the police and the community members. Mm-hmm. There were rallies against sexual assault that some of the police started participating in that were organized by the communities. Mm-hmm. And some of the more like progressive like police units, mm-hmm. they agreed with the community to develop scorecards. So like, all right, let's do this. Let's develop a scorecard with the community of the kinds of things that the community would like to see from the police. Mm-hmm. And those scorecards will be completed regularly, like every quarter, right? Where people would rank how the police were on these scorecards. And the police captains would use those when they were doing reviews, promotions, that kind of stuff. So part of the feedback that they were getting was, what does the community think of you, right?
Yeah.
And eventually they did enough of this work that there was some a couple of big breakthroughs. One of the biggest is some training that was developed out of this program. This took 12 years, but some training that was developed out of this program became mandatory in the orientation of both the military and the police. Over 200,000 soldiers and police officers, 200,000 in the country have now been through that training. We produced a TV show with the police, a drama called Indakisa. Yeah. Uh-huh. It's about a guy, he used to be a rebel. You know, he goes through this UN program to put his guns down. Now he wants to serve his community. So he decides he's going to become a police officer. He becomes a cadet. Yeah. And the show picks up just as he's graduated. And he's all excited to serve his community, except it's very real. It's very gritty. He hasn't been paid for 3 months. The community that he wants, he's surrounded by corrupt cops.
Yeah.
The community that he's supposed to serve hates him or they're scared of him. Like, and so now it follows this guy. It's his life. He's actually trying to be a good police officer. And we use that show to open up discussions all over the country around around the program. And so anyway, the last evaluation that we did on this, we had levels of sexual assault in the worst areas in the east of the country had dropped by more than 50%. You know, it was cool. One of the things that the police said, you know, we had like both written answers and like choose your answer. One of the most common written answers that the police put in was that people actually call us now. They were like, people call us now. We used to be the last people. That they
I don't call LAPD. I tell you that right now. Like, I don't call them. Yeah.
So the police were like, really? They were like, this is amazing. People actually call us when there's a problem. So anyway, that's one story. There's another story I could share with you. I just came back from visiting our team. I think I mentioned to you when I saw you in New York. I had just come back with a couple of the other board members from Kenya.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And like, you know, one of the things that's happening all around the world is, you know, you see more and more terrorist attacks and attacks by, they call them non-state armies, right? So people like you aren't, you know. And so in Kenya, you had some really bad attacks from the Al-Shabaab terror group. You know, they blew up the American embassy in Kenya. They came in with machine guns and shot up shopping malls, killed so many people in the country. And oftentimes what happens is that the government's response to these things in some ways, the cure is as bad as the disease, right? They're so heavy-handed. They come down, they abuse the entire population. They're just cracking down on everybody because they don't know what to do, right? They don't know how to fight these groups. So in Kenya, what they did was they realized that these people from Al-Shabaab, from the terrorist group, they were coming in through the through from the shore. They were pretending to be fishermen. And there's night fishing. People go out. It's a big part of the economy along the coast of Kenya is people go out fishing at night. Yeah. They bring the catches in at dawn and they sell them at the market. Right.
Yeah.
Well, when the government realized that people were posing as night fishermen so they could infiltrate the country with their weapons, they just banned it. They banned night fishing. They shut down night fishing.
Yeah, and that's not going
to... They destroyed the economy, basically, of that whole coastal area as a way to stop terrorism. And you can imagine what happened, right? Like, people lost their jobs. They got pissed off. There was a lot of clashes between the police and the communities along the shore. This went on for 6 years. Yeah. And are incredibly, there's a woman there named Judy Kamamo who runs all of our programs there. Kenyan woman who used to work for Wangari Maathai, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for her Kenyan environmental activism. Anyway, so Judy had this idea. She started shuttling back and forth between the police, the fishermen, the youth groups. She went to some of the human rights organizations that were saving all their money to sue the government. Others of them were using their money to organize protests. And she said, look, why don't you put some of the money for protests and lawsuits into an idea that I've got here, where we could try to build some trust between the police and the community and come up with a solution that would allow us to get the fishing started again, but would actually prevent some of this terrorism. And long story short, it took about six and a half months of shuttling back and forth, creatively listening than talking. And eventually Judy was able to get these groups coming together, and they came up with an idea of getting these electronic scan cards. Like, if you're going to fish off the coast of Kenya, you have to be registered anyway, right?
Yeah.
But there was never any way of kind of verifying it. So they got these scan cards that they would say, okay, if you're a fisherman and you get registered, you get this little card, and all of the police are equipped with little scanners, and they can just scan. As long as you've got a card, you're legit. That simple solution only came about when the groups started talking to each other that Judy had brought together, the fishermen collective, the youth groups, the police themselves, and they reopened night fishing after 6 years. So the whole economy was revived basically because one woman was like, this is crazy. You know, nobody's being served. You know,
you're driving us into the hands of the very people
you're trying to.
Yeah. And that's something that actually leads me to the next thing, where it's like, you know, sometimes it's, I forget the name of the Harvard study, but like, when the powers that be crack down so hard that you eventually almost guarantee the birth of a new resistance or terrorist group. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's almost guaranteed. It's like, you just prove their point by coming down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is like, I've been having this conversation with a lot of, you know, Israelis and supporters of Israel lately in terms of how the war is going on right now.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to ask you. Yeah.
You know, if it is not, let's say with the war that's going on, even if your only concern, literally, even if your only concern was Israel's security, even if you had no concerns, no humanitarian concerns, no concerns about human rights, even if your only concern was, I got to assure the security of Israel, if that was all you cared about, this would not be the way to get there.
Yeah.
Because it has never been the case that a massive military assault on a terrorist group or a violent extremist group that caused huge civilian casualties ended the threat.
Ever.
What it does is it metastasizes it. Either, like you said, it either gives birth to Hamas 2.0, whatever that would look like, or it sort of disperses it, and you get a lot more extremism, you know, and violent extremism that targets people, you know, Israelis, Jews, others outside of Israel. And that's a big fear that I've got right now in terms of where this is all heading. And saying that is not, you know, intended to sort of negate in any way that the Israelis need to be secure. But it's just like, it's interesting because there's this, you know, the UN Development Program is like the biggest agency in the UN. So this is the people doing development work all around the world.
Yeah.
And they put out the biggest reports on what drives people into violent extremist groups. And they were particularly studying the case of all the African nations. And I think it was called the Pathway to Extremism. And it was, they did a study in 2017, and then they repeated it, I think, 5 years later, five years later in 2022. And they had the same, and this is huge research, right?
Yeah.
And they said, look, there are lots of different factors and lots of different places, but the number one most common experience of young people who joined violent extremist groups was being mistreated by security forces.
Yeah.
Like,
it's just number one. Yeah.
And that goes to the Kenya example too. Like those people who like were being, you know, getting into street protests and being beaten up by the police because the night fishing had been closed. Like you said, they're much more like, if I'm an Al Shabaab recruiter, that's ripe territory for me. I can get those guys, you know.
You see what they're doing to you? These people don't care about you, yo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
The wait is over. The Chi is back on Paramount Plus, and the stakes have never been higher. Everything changes on the South Side when a new threat comes to power in the Showtime original series from Emmy winner Lena Waithe. Battle lines will be drawn, alliances will shift, and danger lies around every corner, leaving everyone to wonder who they can trust. Visit ParamountPlus.com/TheShot to get a 50% discount off the Paramount Plus with Showtime annual plan. Offer ends July 14th. Subscription auto-renews. Restrictions apply.
Okay, I love Walker Hayes. He's amazing. He's so fun. Such a great entertainer. And that's why I'm so excited that JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. The Walker Hayes for JCPenney collection is an upbeat playlist of instant classics with laid-back appeal and down-home vibes. As a dad of 7 kids, he knows exactly what fathers want and need when it comes to their style. This collection reflects his casually cool styles with outdoor-inspired details and versatile colors. Perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th, just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
Man, so I'm gonna dial up the difficulty of the questions now, you know, because we've been softballing you. So now, again, in the context of like Gaza and Israel, which like obviously there are certain things you can't talk about because it's still going on right now. You know what I'm saying? As far as like what exactly the step is and the hope for when the bombing stops, like what we're supposed to do. But I think that there are times that there are moments where like the right and wrong is pretty clear. Like this is wrong, you know, and to be still in a position of saying peace building, it's like, to keep people coming to the table, there may be some things that you can't say out loud for the purpose of keeping them at the table. At the same time, the other people you're trying to keep to the table is looking at you going like, but you know this is wrong, right? And with something like you said, with something of like the response of the nation of Israel to this situation, it's like, well, this is tactically, pragmatically, and humanitarian. Like, this is wrong, you know. Now, you know, this is Hamas is a whole other conversation. I'm talking about like where we are right now, and like you said before, which you told us earlier, where it's like, well, we were no closer to a a two-state solution or a peace on October 6th than we were October 7th. Like, we wasn't making no progress before, you know what I'm saying? And when you listen to the leaders of Hamas, they're like, our biggest thing was like, the world stopped talking about us. Like, people stopped caring about our situation. Like, y'all just, like everybody's normalizing with Israel, but 10 years ago, you were saying they need to figure out this situation. Now y'all not worried about it. So we was like, well, how do we get y'all to still talk about us? You know? And then in the middle of all that, 21,000 people are dead. The hospitals have failed. There's no, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's yeah. all this carnage that happens in the middle of that, to where anyone with a heart, like you say, anybody with a heart could be like, this, I mean, this is wrong. Like, how do you stay at the table? Or yeah, Shamil, but as an orc, how do you stay at the table? How do you stay in the peace building when in your heart there is something that's like, well, this is wrong, you know?
So our identity, you know, you were nice in your introduction to me of sort of saying that I'm, you know, I don't put myself out there as much or whatever. Mm-hmm. But that's not just an issue of being sort of humble. Like,
yeah.
Our power is our identity, and our identity isn't me just because I'm the CEO.
Yeah.
In each place where we're working, our identity is a multi-partial team that's drawn from the community, and they're not doing what they're doing out of charity. This is life and death for them, in all the places where we're working. Yeah. So when you asked that really powerful question just now, imagine my Israeli and Palestinian colleagues sitting here, right? And the mm-hmm. question is, how the hell are you all willing to do anything together, right, in the midst of what's going on? Shouldn't you be calling it out? And you know, these are the hardest times. The power of our work, not surprisingly, is kind of the most invisible when you're in the midst of massive, horrible, unacceptable violence.
Yeah.
And people get really, I mean, look, I don't think that, let me start from this place. There are two ways to drive change.
Okay.
I think there are probably a million ways to drive change, but there are two ways to drive change. What I want to share. There's an adversarial approach, which basically says, I'm going to find everyone who agrees with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to identify everyone who disagrees with me on this mm-hmm. issue. And I'm going to organize myself with the first group against the latter group. We're going to go to mm-hmm. war, literally or figuratively.
Right? Yeah.
And that's an adversarial approach, and it's a win-lose approach.
Yeah.
Right. And it can be effective in a lot of places. The other approach to driving change is, I'm going to take an issue I really care about, and I'm going to find out everybody who has a stake in how that issue plays out. Everybody, mm-hmm. including the people who most disagree with me.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to figure out how to build trust between them so that we can come up with a solution where everyone's dignity is respected.
Bet.
Now, it might sound like I'm avoiding your question, but I'm jumping to the end state, which is Israelis and Palestinians aren't going anywhere.
Yeah.
They're not going anywhere. This is where they're going to be. And so I would not push anyone. And right now is kind of the hardest time to get Israelis and Palestinians to do anything together. We wouldn't push them to do this together.
Yeah,
but we are staying in very close touch with our teams and then with our partners to provide whatever we can to sustain them and to make sure their dignity is intact and that their voices are being heard. And as soon as the openings are there for us to start building, we're going to start helping them to build. But that 20-year clock we talked about is going to start again.
Yeah.
When the guns fall silent.
Yeah.
That's what violence does.
Yeah.
You can have decades of development that are wiped out in weeks of violent conflict.
Yeah.
That's why when we started, we talked about peace being the foundation, being like oxygen, everything else that depends on it. So, you know, I don't know if I answered your question, but it's, you know, we could spend a lot of time with me issuing statements about Israel and Gaza right now, but frankly, it's not that they're irrelevant. People need to know that you actually really care. You give a damn about their dignity and their humanity, and that's really important. And if there's going to be a time where we can create a future where both Israelis and Palestinians can live in real dignity and security, that's going to have to be created by them collaboratively. And we are, unfortunately, decades away from that happening now.
Nah, thank you. That's great, because it does sort of get you out of the polarization loop, because there is something that's like, in some senses, it's like, well, we're at the table. We're here because, well, the violence is wrong. Like, that's what we're here about. You know what I'm saying? Like, nobody wants their babies to die. Like this, I mean, that's, nobody wants their babies to die. So like you said, I can issue statements, I could rally around the team, or I can say what you said, which I think is beautiful. It's like, who's invested in this? Who's really invested in this? And let's build trust around this and have a conversation around providing dignity for the people invested in here. And like you said, once the shooting stops, then the other things happen. So like, you know, without being too trivial, there's a man out here named Big U, former Rolling 60 Crip, notorious. Anyway, he started a football team league for like Pop Warner. It's just, you know, Crenshaw Cougars, you know what I'm saying? To where it's like, I am, you all know what set I'm from. I have sworn enemies. Don't get me wrong. You know what I'm saying? Like I am a Crip. Like that, I don't know what else you want me to say. I'm a Crip, you know what I'm saying? But our children should be able to play outside. And it is what it is. Our children should be able to play outside, you know? And over the years, like when I did finally, I get a chance to meet him, it was in passing, because since I didn't live on that side of town, I wasn't really a part of a lot of stuff they did. I lived in the Latino community, but I was a part of intervention programs that were inspired by him, you know, and was able to say, hey man, like I lived with the Latinos, but they was inspired by this. Yeah.
So can I ask you a question about that? So like before he did that, would you have ever guessed that he would do that? Would anyone?
Never in a million years.
I feel like this is the thing about, let's take this to Israel-Palestine again, if we want to stay on that hard topic. Like, there's a lot of things I don't know. And people who predict the future of this conflict, you know, whatever, more power to them. But there's one thing I know, which is that when peace comes here, it's going to be negotiated by people you never would have expected, agreeing to things that you never would believe they would have agreed to. And we saw that between the British government and the IRA. People forget the IRA was bombing hotels. They were bombing, they set off, you know, saw that between the FARC rebel movement and the Colombian government after 50 years of civil war. We said, like, you go out down the list, even in this conflict, right? You know, when Rabin and Arafat signed the Oslo Accords, like everything that's being said about Hamas right now was said about the PLO.
About the PLO, listeners, and we have an episode coming up about that backstory of the PLO and the Oslos, but I'm going to do that history. But yeah, go on.
Yeah. So, and you know, the Palestinian Authority, which is in the West Bank, is the descendants of the PLO. Mm-hmm. That's what the PLO turned into.
Yeah.
When they signed a peace agreement. And they said, we're laying down our weapons. Now we're going to administer the West Bank, right? Mm-hmm. And you take that model, and no one's saying that they've turned violent. They haven't. Even through all of what's been going on, you know?
Yeah.
You take that model and you compare it to a model of a military attack. Mm-hmm. When the Israeli military went into Lebanon to get the PLO out of Beirut, which is where they were headquartered for a while, that massive military invasion led to the rise in Hezbollah.
Yeah.
Which now is seen as a bigger threat than anyone else, right? Like, it's like what you said earlier. Like, if I'm not saying that military action is, you know, people never use military action. Yeah. Like, I don't know, but I will say that when you're dealing with an extremist group, a group that's using violent means to pursue political ends, right? And they're embedded in a community, any community.
Yeah.
If you're going to use military tactics that kill a lot of civilians in that community, it's inevitable that you're going to create more of what you seek to destroy.
Yeah. Man, even today, there was a leader of Hamas that got popped in Lebanon today. So we'll see what comes out. We'll see what comes out from it. But yeah, I think, okay, so lastly, we've been dancing around it. We've actually been defining it this whole time, but it's this last term that has really stuck out for me, which is multipartial. And multipartial is not neutral, right? It's not disinterested. I think a lot of times people say, well, like, I'm neutral in this situation. And it's like, well, that don't capture it. Like, neutral don't help. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, this is our core identity.
Yes.
And it's, you know, people hear the term impartial or neutral and they think, oh, you're like a third party arbitrator. Like, you come in from the outside and you hear the different groups and you or media. That's not who we are. Like, there are six things about being multipartial that I think are uniquely powerful. Yeah. First, there's real humanity in it. We were just talking about it with Israel Palestine. You could talk about it in LA with communities you were just talking about. Like, there's a real humanity when the team is not only local but represents the divided communities. That means that when they're not detached about what's going on, they're directly feeling it. Their families' future is at stake. It's a life and death thing for them. So there's a humanity to it. Second, there's a credibility to it. You've got unique access and convening power. When, if your team, again, includes like former youth activists and leaders, former gang members, retired cops or whatever, and you're trying to deal with police community violence, there's going to be a unique credibility to that team if they could ever create themselves as a real team. Third, there's wisdom. And this is where what you were talking about before, like this relationship between justice and peace, I think is really misunderstood. Mm-hmm. Really misunderstood. Ooh, I think the notion that peace is just, you know, when Martin Luther King said that peace is not just the absence of tension, but the presence of justice. Like, I don't think that, I think when you have people who represent the different communities themselves, they understand that you can't get justice without peace and you can't get peace without justice, right?
Yes.
And it can be hard to say this because it seems like you're letting oppressors off the hook, but unjust systems, I was always inspired by Mandela and King and Tutu and James Baldwin, even the author, like, who understood, or Gandhi, they understood that unjust systems trap everyone.
Yes.
Which is not the same thing as saying they oppress everyone equally. That would be really obscene. But, like, we know that's not the case.
Yeah.
But they limit everybody. And what all of those activists created was a future that uplifted everyone's dignity and humanity. Yeah. It didn't just flip the power tables.
Yes.
It didn't just say, okay, you oppress the group, now the other group's going to be in charge.
Yeah.
So there's wisdom. There's wisdom. That's the third thing. There's humanity, credibility, wisdom. The fourth thing is pragmatism. Like, you know, there are all these international advocates, people issuing statements on Israel, Palestine. You just put your finger on it. We're always going to defer to what our Israeli and Palestinian team jointly is willing to say and do.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to override that by saying, but wait, our organization has to say this, whether or not you think it's important. No. We either say things because they think we should say them, or we keep our mouths shut because they say, keep your mouth shut. We're working on something.
Right? Yes.
And so there's pragmatism in that. Fifth, there's authenticity. And I love this. You can't create a more inclusive world with more like exclusivist advocacy. You can't create a cooperative world through adversarial advocacy. Like, you really align your means and your ends.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you, Gandhi's whole thing about be the change you want to see in the world. There's real authenticity in that, because you're not saying, hey, we're going to get to this peaceful place, but the way we're going to get there is really adversarial and nasty.
Yeah.
No, that doesn't work. And the sixth thing is there's a real bias towards action. Uh-huh. Like, when you're multipartial, when your team is local and from the communities, they don't have a lot of patience for just having talk shops. They're like, look, dialogue is necessary. Mm-hmm. But it's totally insufficient. You need dialogue to understand where people are coming from. But if that doesn't translate into action that's meaningful to people, that actually meets communities' needs and demands, people are going to get really negative about dialogue. You see this in the Middle East about peace process. It's like a dirty word. Because people feel like, you know what? We've been there. We've done that.
Yeah, we've done that.
Anyway, those are the power themes of multipartiality, of humanity, credibility, wisdom, pragmatism, authenticity, and this like bias towards action are.
Beautiful. Is peace possible?
It's inevitable, but not without a hell of a lot of work, right? I will tell you one thing. When I was You know Sister Helen Prejean? She wrote a book. Okay. So like the author of Dead Men Walking and the Catholic nun who's she's now accompanied six men to their death in the leading anti-death penalty activist in the country, probably. And I had the honor to meet her recently. Somebody said, this is also hopeless. Like, what can we do? Yeah. And I can never channel her. I should send you the audio of what she said. But she just said, just do one thing. She said, because when you're standing on the sidelines and you're just watching how horrible everything is, you just go into despair and cynicism. But when you do just one thing, no matter how small it is, even if it's like just very little, it only makes a little change in your own little community with one person, you're actually releasing an energy into the community that gathers momentum, right? Mm-hmm. And you generate hope in yourself and in others when you do that one thing. And you can never understand like how far that hope is actually going to go. So peace is possible as long as we work for it. And I think she said to one of the first men who she accompanied to the death chamber, they had an argument, a big argument, when she was trying to convince him or encourage him to acknowledge what he had done to seek forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, all you do is pray. And she said, no, I pray and I work.
Good.
I pray and I work. So anyway, peace is possible, but only if we work, if we pray and we work.
Hallelujah, dog. Okay, you out here preaching. Bill be preaching, y'all. Man, hey, thank you so much for your time. Dude, I know you're super busy. It's like there's so much happening on the planet, right? My Lord, like, I know we're involved in Sudan right now. Like, I know there's just so much happening right now. Thank you for taking your time to holler at us and present this to us.
Thanks so much for having me, Bob. And thanks for being such a supporter of Search for Common Ground. It's great to have you on board, honestly.
Of course. Guys, please go to the website, sfcg.org. We'll take donations. You know what I'm saying? And please tap in with us, man. Like, again, it's people out here. Like, I know how bleak the world is, but it's people out here actually on the ground doing the good work.
Thanks so much. Man. Peace be to you.
Peace be to you. All right, now don't you hit stop on this pod. You better listen to these credits. I need you to finish this thing so I can get the download numbers, okay? So don't stop it yet. But listen, this was recorded in East Los Boyle Heights by your boy Propaganda. Tap in with me at prophiphop.com. If you're in the cold brew coffee, we got Terraform Cold Brew. You can go there.com and use promo code HOOD, get 20% off, get yourself some coffee. This was mixed, edited, and mastered by your boy Matt Osowski, killing the beat softly. Check out his website, mattosowski.com. I'm going to spell it for you because I know. MattOsowski.com. MattOsowski.com. He got more music and stuff like that on there. So go and check out the heat. Hood Politics is a member of Cool Zone Media, executive produced by Sophie Lichterman, part of the iHeartMedia Podcast Network. Your theme music and scoring is also by the one and only Matt Osowski, still killing the beat softly. So listen, don't let nobody lie to you. If you understand urban living, you understand politics. These people is not smarter than you. We'll see y'all next week.
The wait is over. The Chi is back on Paramount Plus, and the stakes have never been higher. Everything changes on the South Side when a new threat comes to power in the Showtime original series from Emmy winner Lena Waithe. Battle lines will be drawn, alliances will shift, and danger lies around every corner, leaving everyone to wonder who they can trust. Visit ParamountPlus.com/The Chi to get a 50% discount off the Paramount Plus with Showtime annual plan. Offer ends July 14th. Subscription auto-renews. Restrictions apply.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.